Whenever one talks with an investigator in dermatologic oncology, it's pretty hard to get past the impressive developments in melanoma, but there are other important skin cancers, and I met with Dr. Anna Pavlik for her take on these, beginning with systemic treatment of advanced squamous cell cancer. And to begin, Dr. Pavlik commented on the incidence of this disease.
I believe that they're out there. As the cutaneous oncologist, I can tell you in the last year, I've probably seen between 10 and 12. We also work with the fellows at Bellevue, and just in the last 3 months alone, we've had 3 cases that we've presented of metastatic invasive squamous cell of the skin. So, you know, I think as patients start to present with more metastatic disease, I think it's going to become something that's going to become a little bit more obvious. Clearly, the patients who are at highest risk is patients who are on immunosuppression for transplant, and those really, when they decide to metastasize, have exceedingly aggressive disease. However, we've seen a very broad spectrum of other patients, particularly because, like I said, I work at Bellevue as well. We have now 3 Hispanic patients who you would never think would be patients presenting with any type of skin cancer because they've got a darker skin color, who have had squamous cell cancer on their face that just really never went for any type of therapy. And when they did go for something, it had already metastasized to the lymph nodes.
What about the treatment of squamous cell, metastatic squamous cell? How do you think that through?
Systemic treatment, if you're going to pick a treatment, you know, you can look at cetuximab as, you know, an EGFR monoclonal antibody to be used in combination with either radiation, if you're going to give radiation to the patient, or you can use a platinum-based regimen. You know, again, there's no firm standard as to what you do. You extrapolate from the regimens that are out there.
Can you talk a little bit about the 40-year-old man who had squamous cell that you had?
Yeah, he was probably one of the most dramatic cases that I've seen. He claims that he had a long-term history of trauma to his right anterior tibial area that never really, quote, healed over the course of his life. Because he was the primary breadwinner for a very large family, he worked as a janitor in a school. When this area became more ulcerated and open, because according to him, it never really ever healed from the time he was a teenager, he would just wrap it and go to work. Well, here it is now 3 or 4 years after it's gotten ulcerated. He presents to our emergency room around Thanksgiving with 103 fever and rigors. And when we actually examine the patient, we see that there's a gigantic squamous cell that's essentially eaten away at his entire right lower extremity. The lesion starts at his ankle and extends up to his knee. It's foul-smelling. It's infected. He was cultured. He grew out Pseudomonas as well as staph, but it was not MRSA because obviously he had never been in the hospital. We treated him with some broad-spectrum antibiotics, and at that point he did not have distant disease. However, he did have one palpable femoral triangle node, which we biopsied and was positive. So in an attempt to try to give him neoadjuvant therapy, thinking that maybe we could try to save his leg, I gave him neoadjuvant paclitaxel and carboplatin. And he had an exceedingly dramatic response with complete resolution of the femoral lymph node, improvement of the visual tumor that we could see on his leg. But before we decided to try and save his leg, the surgeon went back and re-biopsied several areas, and there was still invasive squamous cell deep into the bone. So as a consequence, he wound up getting an above-the-knee amputation and an inguinal node dissection. The inguinal nodes on that dissection were negative, and the patient was sent to rehab. He came back to see me 3 months later and just said he wasn't feeling well. At that point, we re-imaged him, and he had diffuse metastatic disease to the bone, to the liver, all the way up and down his pariaortic nodes, and was so debilitated in such a quick way that we were never able to treat him again.
Hmm. So he never got any further systemic therapy?
He did not.
Just kind of curious, do you know whether or not anti-PD-1 antibodies have been used in this situation? There were some responses seen in squamous cell carcinoma of the lung.
Again, because it's such a rare incidence of metastatic disease of the skin, and trying to get people on PD-1 trials right now. Most of the PD-1 trials are really focused on melanoma. You have to find a phase 1 PD-1, either PD-1 alone, PD-1 with another antibody, PD-1 with IPI. And I really don't think if you get a patient on that study, is it going to be meaningful because it's going to be an N of 1.
Let's talk a little bit about basal cell. Maybe you can talk a little bit again about what we know about the epidemiology and your own clinical experience in terms of when these kinds of patients end up seeing oncologists.
I have to tell you, I've been in practice now over 15 years. And up until there was a drug that was developed for metastatic basal cell, I did not see one of these patients and honestly didn't even think they existed. I had seen some patients referred to me by our dermatologist who had familial basal carcinoma where they had locally advanced basal cells, but never had I seen metastatic disease up until I opened a clinical trial that was looking for metastatic basal cell cancer patients, and all of a sudden I now have 6. And again, I think part of the issue is lack of public awareness, lack of education, and denial in a lot of patients, where if they see something, if I do nothing, maybe it'll just go away. Because these stories are all the same. They're all people who will relate that there was something there for years, and it got worse, and it got worse. Well, you know, and then it gets worse to the point of where, well, then something popped up as a lymph node in the area. And so most of my metastatic basal cells are really from patients who I think were really just afraid that it was cancer and never went to the doctor until it was really too late. And I have another lady very similar to the squamous cell patient we talked about. She had a large basal cell on her leg. It continued to grow. She finally decided to do something about it. Couldn't get clean margins. She wound up having an above-the-knee amputation also as a consequence. Did well for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden now pops up with lung mets, a large pelvic mass that was actually obstructing her ureter, required a nephrostomy tube. And she also has diffuse basal cells all over the rest of her body as well. So she went on a clinical trial with a hedgehog inhibitor, and she has had a 50% reduction in her disease volume.
This was vismodegib?
No, this is a clinical trial.
It's another agent.
Mm-hmm.
So there are multiple hedgehog inhibitors being looked at?
There are. There's only one that's FDA approved that you can treat without a clinical trial. But we had opened this clinical trial, and obviously if we can enroll someone to a research study, that's what we'd like to do.
These are all oral agents?
They are.
And just in terms of this lady, so she's had a good response. How long has it been now?
Almost a year.
Wow. And has she had any toxicity from treatment?
Absolutely. These are not easy drugs to take. You know, it's along the same lines as the BRAF inhibitors. Everybody thinks it's a pill. It's easy. You pop it, you go. Every drug has its side effects. And so she has had a significant alteration in her taste. She is completely alopecic, lost all her hair. She now wears a wig. She has had intermittent muscle cramps, which is another big complaint. But those have seemed to resolve now over time.
You see these same things with vismodegib?
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit more about the change in taste? You know, what patients complain about and how much does it bother them?
It bothers them a lot. To talk to patients, either things just taste like nothing or they just taste like metal. And we've actually had some patients try to eat with plastic forks and knives, thinking that, okay, if you don't eat with metal, maybe you won't perturb the metal taste in your mouth. Doesn't help. In fact, we've had a couple of patients who asked about 3 months before the holidays to come off on a vacation just so they can enjoy holiday food, and then they'd go back on.
Wow, does that work?
It has.
So after a while, you start to get the taste back
Yeah.
once you stop the drug?
Yeah.
Interesting. And is this thought to be a direct toxic effect on the taste buds?
No, we don't know why. We have no idea why it would even cause muscle cramps, and that's, I think, the bigger issue. Is that these muscle cramps wake people up in the middle of the night. We've tried quinine, we've tried, you know, lorazepam, magnesium, checking people's electrolytes, and it really is a head scratcher.
What do we know about the biology of basal cell? Why was this even looked at?
I think because it's one of those orphan cancers doesn't respond to chemotherapy.
I mean, is there a mutation in hedgehog pathway or biologically? Why would explain?
Well, what? if you look at basal cells and the way that these hedgehog inhibitors work, it's through transduction pathways, and there's different proteins in the basal cell like smoothin, and that transports an anti-apoptotic signal to the nucleus, and so these basal cells continue to multiply and divide. When you give a drug like a hedgehog inhibitor, it actually stabilizes those proteins and does not let the signal transduction get to the nucleus. And so the basal cells just stop.
What's seen clinically in terms of efficacy?
Response rates are reported between 40 and 50%. The study that got vismodegib approved was a phase 2 study because, again, these are not patients that are very common. But it was divided into patients who had locally advanced disease and no metastatic disease, or patients who had metastatic disease. And response rates in both arms were pretty equivalent, between 40 and 50%. Average time to progression was about 9 months. Again, very consistent with most of the targets that we see.
And what do we know about the mechanisms of resistance, and is there cross-resistance between these agents?
Because only one agent has been approved, and again, there's so few of these patients, I don't honestly know if someone progresses, would they respond to vismodegib? I don't know.
What about the use of this agent or these types of agents in the neoadjuvant setting, and before surgery to try to shrink things down?
Being looked at, actually, especially for very large basals. They're looking at trying to make surgery easier.
Have you yourself tried that?
I have not, because, again, I'm a medical oncologist, and patients usually get to my doorstep when they have either locally advanced or metastatic disease. However, I'm now working with one of the dermatologists at NYU who really sees a lot of basal cell, and we've actually talked about before he would go and try to do a large Mohs procedure for these people, can we actually treat them, shrink down their disease to make the surgery a little bit more tolerable for them.
And, you know, you mentioned the response rate, but I think in terms of like the waterfall plots, it looks like most of these people have some kind of response.
Yeah.
So you would
not. Some better than others.
I mean, you wouldn't expect many to be progressing, which I guess would be the big concern.
No. As far as using neoadjuvant
before
therapy,
surgery,
no, I don't
yeah.
think it's a loser. I think it's clearly may benefit, especially in some older patients whom you may not be so willing to do wide resections and flaps on. Can you downsize the tumor and subsequently do a more limited resection?
In terms of trying to get a better feel for what happens when these patients are treated, one of the things that we like to ask people is, you know, sort of globally, if a patient is about to begin, for example, vismodegib, ask you, you know, what's the chance I'm going to go through? And understanding that this is just your clinical gestalt, there aren't that much data, et cetera, says, you know, what's the chance I'm going to cruise through this thing like a placebo? I won't even know I'm going to take in it. What's the chance I'm going to have some problems, but I'm going to be okay and you can change the dose or whatever? And what's the chance I'm going to have to come off therapy because of problems?
I've only had one woman who's had to come off therapy because of toxicity, and those were excruciating muscle lip cramps. We could not control them. She's pretty much cried 24 hours a day, and we just had to stop. What's the incidence of nobody having any real side effects and flying through it? I would say that's pretty much zero. You're going to get something. Even if you don't get the muscle cramps, most people do complain of the taste changes. And pretty much everyone I've treated with either one of the two hedgehog inhibitors has developed, if not complete, then pretty significant alopecia.
Any new strategies in systemic management of basal cell you find interesting?
One of the things that we're now exploring, because there was the reports in the literature looking at the BRAF mutated melanomas, and should you pulse therapy them, you know, give them drug, take them off before they progress, when they're stable, when they start to progress, treat them again. I think a lot of us are also thinking that way about basal cell. You know, because the chronic toxicity of this drug can be pretty significant, and if you keep them on and you know they're eventually going to progress between 9 months and a year, can you get them under good control in 3 months, give them a holiday for 3 months, restart them again? You know, my patients who like the fact that summer comes and the winter holidays are 6 months apart, says, give me drug for 3 months. But again, these are locally advanced patients. These are not patients with metastatic disease who are making these judgments to come off. But patients with locally advanced disease, their tumors get significantly better, but they feel significantly worse. So the payoff is, we'll treat you for 3 months, we stop for 3 months, you feel better, your disease is probably going to start to grow back, and then 3 months later, after the holidays are over, we put you back on meds, you get your disease back under control, and now it's the summer, so you go away for the summer, you don't have to worry about drug.
Let's talk a little bit about melanoma, and I thought we could begin by talking about adjuvant therapy. If you can talk about sort of where we are with that and how you go about making clinical decisions.
Unfortunately, where we are right now is nowhere different than we were about 10 years ago. The only approved adjuvant therapy that's out there is interferon, whether it's high-dose interferon that you give someone or pegylated interferon. You know, it's the same animal, just in a different form. And that's what's out there for people, unless they choose to participate in research studies.
How do you go about making recommendations to patients? I've seen a lot of variability in this. There are some people who are pretty anti-adjuvant therapy, and there are others who are pretty pro. Where do you fit in?
I kind of sit in the middle. I think each patient who walks in my door gets evaluated for the extent of their disease, how old they are, their comorbidities. Do I really think that they're going to benefit from adjuvant therapy? I think most people will get my talk of, you've got three options. You've got option number one is to do nothing. No matter what stage they are between stage two and stage three when it comes to adjuvant, I do not believe that's clearly a wrong thing to do. Option number two is, well, we've got the standard, and that standard is either high-dose IV interferon followed by maintenance or subcutaneous pegylated. Or option number three is participation in a research study, which may be just as good as option number one of doing nothing, because we can't tell you that we're going to impact your overall survival. And anybody who comes in from a 2B clear through to a 3C gets that same talk, because I can't make any firm recommendations because I don't think the data allows me to say, well, you know, you're a 2C, you're a 2B. Although if you look at some of Alex Eggermont's retrospective analysis, he'll argue that the earlier stage patients, the 2Bs, 2Cs, and 3As, if you're going to get benefit from interferon, that's probably the subclass that probably does benefit. And so if I have a 22-year-old, like I did last week, who comes in with a 3A melanoma, I talk to him about interferon.
What happened incidentally with that conversation? Where did that lead?
She said, yeah. So it's not like I don't give interferon. I just don't give a lot. I think it's very thought out. I present people with the data so that they know that they're not expecting that this is going to be a home run and that there's going to be overwhelming benefit. I think my experience has been that as the older you get, the more that you hear a number of maybe we're going to give you 9 to 10% benefit becomes less meaningful. And so it's usually the younger people who opt to say, well, I'll give it a start. Let's start it. And if I don't tolerate it, is it okay for me to stop? And my answer is sure.
And just out of curiosity, what kind of interferon are you going to give this woman?
I'm still the IV high dose. And I'll tell you why. Because I feel like I have better control of their symptoms when they're in the office 5 days a week for that month. I think patients get more accustomed to it. They get closer care. They get closer follow-up. And if symptoms happen, they're in my office every day. I have used pegylated interferon. I've seen some pretty significant toxicities with those, and we've had to manage those over the phone because, again, patients are not used to coming in every day. They'll call you and say they have Rigers and 103 fever, and what do you mean you want me to come in tomorrow? So if I had to pick, I still pick the old-fashioned high-dose interferon.
Looking at the data, any way to tease out whether or not pegylated interferon maybe is less toxic?
I don't believe it's less toxic at all.
So what's the advantage? Why did it get approved?
I think if you look at the data, it was totally equivalent to interferon with respect to efficacy. But I think the advantage is that patients don't need to come to your office for an entire month to get hooked up with an IV infusion. You give him an injection and, you know, it's a little bit more, I think the idea was supposed to be more quality of life improving, but I will argue that their quality of life is really not any better than someone who comes in, gets hydrated, gets antiemetics, and gets treated in the office and then goes home.
So what do you think you're going to be seeing over the next period of time as this woman is getting treated? What are the typical kinds of problems you run into?
Usually the first week kind of sorts out how people really do with this drug. Most of the time it's fever and chills. We've created a nice algorithm for patients and tell them that while the patient's being treated, we send their family member to the pharmacy across the street and say, you're going to go buy this, 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 and this, and then we're going to give you a recipe that you're going to follow. And if this recipe doesn't work, well, then you're going to call me and I'm going to tell you what else to do. But in general, most people, if they follow directions, they do fine. Because again, the biggest side effects are really the fever and the chills, feeling kind of flu-y, maybe a little fatigued. Occasionally, I've had a person say that they felt nauseated. It's not very common. The other big complaint from people who are actively working in high impact jobs is the mental clouding and not being able to really focus.
What about clinical trial options? For example, is there a clinical trial option? Was there one for this patient you saw?
This patient, being a 3A, did not have a clinical trial option that we had open. And most of the large clinical trial studies right now are looking at patients with 3B and 3C disease. I think the most actively accruing is 1609, ECOG 1609, which compares 1 year of high-dose interferon to 1 year of ipilimumab to see if there really is any significant impact.
1 year of ipilimumab or four doses?
1 year.
So how many doses is that?
It's four doses of induction, and then at 24 weeks, they would start with three additional doses of maintenance.
Just getting back to this lady, what in your mind, or maybe even this came up in the conversation, is her risk for recurrence with and without this treatment?
She was a 3A, so she had essentially low volume disease. She had a micrometastatic focus in her sentinel lymph node, and the remaining nodes were all negative. Honestly, hands down, I think she probably would have done fine if she did nothing. But again, I'm not willing to take that chance in someone who's 22 years old where there is something that may provide her with an extra 9% to 10% benefit.
Absolute benefit?
No.
But I mean, is there a number in your head, okay, roughly this is the chance she's going to recur without any treatment?
Without any treatment, I think her chance of recurring is probably about 35 to 40%.
And you think that'll come down by 9%?
No.
What will it come down to?
You know, I think she would get the benefit of interferon of would she benefit by having a prolonged duration before she recurs? Yeah. And sometimes I honestly treat young people like that, hoping that even if I can delay their time to recurrence by the quoted 3 month duration, I may have so many better drugs out there for them in a shorter period of time. So am I going to take her risk from 35 to like 20%? No. No. You know, I'll probably bring it down maybe 35%, maybe to 30% overall benefit.
What are the other adjuvant strategies being looked at right now in clinical trials? You mentioned the ipilimumab study.
There are other studies that are now looking at patients who have, again, stage 3B and 3C disease, and we're looking to see if they have a BRAF mutation. And those patients are being randomized to either get 1 year of adjuvant vemurafenib versus observation.
And have you had patients go on studies like that?
I have not opened that study yet, so I haven't.
What do you anticipate it's going to be like to give vemurafenib for a year in the adjuvant setting, knowing that maybe they're going to be cured without it?
Well, again, these are the high-risk patients. These are the 3Bs and the 3Cs that have a risk of recurrence somewhere between like 60 and 75%. So if you're going to give them toxicity, it's easier to swallow than it is for somebody who's like a 3A. I think you can get them through. I think just like interferon, with a little bit of practice and dose adjusting, you can get anybody through anything.
Let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease in terms of metastatic melanoma. I'm curious, what are some of the common questions you receive from oncologists or, you know, maybe myths or misperceptions you think that might be out there about this topic?
I think there's actually a couple. I think misconception number one is that a BRAF mutation is a genetically transmitted mutation, and oh my God, do I need to have my brothers and sisters and my children tested because I don't want them to get this? And so I really try to make it very clear that this is an intrinsic mutation within the tumor that is not going to be genetically spread to their family, because I get that hands down with probably every metastatic patient who walks in the door. I think one of the issues that some of the community docs have with melanoma, because again, it's not a very common cancer like colon cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, is that if someone has a BRAF mutation, you should reflexively just put them on a BRAF inhibitor. And I think many of us who spend our lives working with only skin cancers will argue that that's probably not the right thing to do. It shouldn't be just a knee-jerk response. BRAF mutation equals BRAF inhibitor as far as frontline therapy goes.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit more about that? There was a paper I actually sent you because I was curious what you thought about it by Dr. Yang and Mike Atkins,
yep.
Which drug and when for patients with BRAF mutant melanoma, published in The Lancet Oncology. And one of the things they go through is what you were just talking about there, you know, the patient who has indolent disease, maybe low volume disease, where, you know, they kind of seem to push the idea of using immune therapy first.
I actually totally agree with Mike. You know, the one drug class that we know that actually provides patients with the possibility of a durable, complete response is immunotherapy. So if you've got someone who's got low volume disease or essentially indolent disease, someone whose LDH is normal, who, you know, really is very functional and fit and doesn't have a lot of symptoms, even if they have a BRAF mutation, many of us will argue that immunotherapy should be given first because, again, you provide them with that possibility that they may be one of the lucky ones who will go on to have a complete and durable response. I don't believe in those patients that you lose anything by doing that because, again, they've got more indolent disease. And if you know they've got a BRAF mutation, you know what you're giving them next and you know that they're going to respond. However, now you're going to a drug that, although you know they're going to respond and they're going to do well, you also know that that's going to be a relatively short-lived therapy.
We got a bunch of questions from oncologists. I'd like to throw a bunch of them out to you related to metastatic melanoma. First, high-dose ipilimumab, 10 milligrams per kilogram, is it more effective than standard dose of 3 milligrams per kilogram?
We actually did that study. That was one of the first studies that we did in the beginning. It was the phase 1 dose escalation of ipilimumab, and that was done probably about 10 years ago. And we looked at 0.3 milligrams per kilogram, 3 milligrams per kilogram, and 10 milligrams per kilogram. And yes, we actually saw that there were much higher responses in the 10 milligram per kilogram arm. However, there was also more toxicity, not that it wasn't manageable. However, they went to the FDA with the trial in heavily pretreated patients. They opted to give them the lower dose for fear that they were already heavily pretreated, not to give them undue toxicity. And I guess was pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised that there was a statistically significant benefit to survival even in this lower dose. And so for those of us who have worked with the 10 milligrams per kilogram, I think if you ask any of us, we'd say, if given the option, we'd much rather have the 10 milligram per kilogram dose. And so they had now completed a trial comparing 3 milligrams to 10 milligrams per kilogram.
But we don't have the results yet.
We do not have those results yet.
I wonder what the cost is going to be.
They would drastically have to change the cost.
It's hard to imagine it'd be three times as great.
It can't be. Insurance companies will never pay for it. They barely pay for the 3 milligram per kilogram dose.
Another question, is there a role for maintenance ipilimumab?
Again, you're asking somebody who's worked with this drug right from the get-go, and most of the studies that we did right from the get-go also included induction with 10 milligrams per kilogram, subsequently followed by maintenance. This one outlier study, the 3 milligram per kilogram in the heavily pretreated patients that didn't give anybody maintenance, was the one that won the race and got to the FDA first. Again, upsetting a lot of us because we're big believers that, yes, you probably do need to continue to prime or nudge I like nudge better. Nudge the immune system along. So you get it revved up. To me, I tell patients it's kind of like starting up your car. You know, most people now don't have to push the gas to get the car to start. But when I was growing up, my father used to say, you have to pump the gas pedal to get the gas into the carburetor, and then you turn the key. So I think those four immediate doses are really like priming the engine, and then you turn the key. And once the key is on, you need to keep filling it up with gas. And so I think those three-month maintenance doses really do benefit patients, and I would love to see that come back. I know there's going to be another study that's going to address that as well.
Here's another question. Any synergy between ipilimumab and chemotherapy? Any synergy between vemurafenib and chemotherapy?
Well, those are loaded questions. Actually, data with the vemurafenib and ipilimumab just came out this week. There was actually a large trial giving patients 960 milligrams POBID of vemurafenib, which is standard dose, along with ipilimumab, although it wasn't 10 milligrams, it was a 3 milligram per kilogram dose. And that study actually had to get closed down because of hepatotoxicity. So do we think that those drugs probably work well together? Yes. However, can we give them safely together? That needs to be further explored.
Speaking of chemotherapy, any comments about which chemotherapeutic agents and in which situations you use chemotherapy in metastatic melanoma and what you thought about the recent report with nab-paclitaxel?
Nab-paclitaxel, if I had to pick that or paclitaxel or docetaxel, I would clearly pick nab-paclitaxel. I think it's just easier to give patients, better tolerated. Yes, you do have to worry about the neurotoxicity, but I think it's very well tolerated. You know, did it beat dacarbazine? Yeah, by my chinny chin chin. But again, you're looking at two chemotherapeutic agents that are really not what we're kind of focused on right now. Does that mean that you don't use them? Absolutely not. You get someone who's got a wild-type BRAF. They don't respond to ipilimumab. They go on to a clinical trial. They get PD-1. They don't respond to PD-1. You don't have another clinical trial for them. What are you going to do? And they still have a performance status of zero. They're working and they're fully functional. It's very hard to look at people like that and say, sorry, there's nothing left for you. And so that's kind of when we go to the chemotherapy. And I think there's also other, I had a patient this week, very similar case scenario, got treated with ipilimumab a year ago, had a beautiful partial response. We watched him. Eventually, it started to grow. When it started to grow, I was able to get reinduction through his insurance company. Gave him four more doses. Well, those four more doses did nothing for him. So he now has really explosive disease with significant intraluminal tumors throughout his GI tract where he's now requiring a blood transfusion every 2 weeks. That's somebody that I sat down and said, listen, before we even think about, first of all, we can't put you on a clinical trial because you're actively bleeding. You don't even have a hemoglobin that we can get you onto a study. We have to try and slow this down. So I talked to him about starting chemotherapy next week with the intent that if I can at least control it and slow it down, it would then offer him other treatment options.
So what kind of chemotherapy are you thinking of using?
We're checking his insurance to see what my options are, you know, and unfortunately, that's probably the cookie cutter answer that most people will give you, because according to Medicare guidelines, you can give him DTIC, you can give him a platinum. Depending on what kind of insurance they have, taxanes are questionable as to whether they're covered or not.
So assuming that cost is not an issue, what would you choose for this patient?
Nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin. I think he's got such rapidly progressing disease that I would want two agents rather than just one.
Any sense for whether or not there's greater efficacy with nab-paclitaxel and paclitaxel?
I don't know. They've never been compared head-to-head.
So one oncologist asks a common question. Approach to patients with melanoma and brain mets who have BRAF-positive tumors, and I see that you are part of a paper in Neuro-Oncology, challenging the current paradigm of melanoma progression, brain metastasis as isolated first visceral site.
Yeah, I am not a big believer in whole brain radiation therapy. We know it's only effective in about 10% of patients, if that. You give them cognitive issues. You make them feel terrible. They get overwhelming fatigue. For 10%, again, at the end of your life, is that 10% to buy you maybe another 4 weeks worth of life in bed? I can't buy that. And so what we did was we looked at patients who came in with brain metastases. However, we kind of looked at two groups, one that had gamma knifeable, you know, limited disease, 3 or 4 mets. You can gamma knife them. They were small. And then no whole brain. You just gave them vemurafenib. Then there's another group that had multiple brain mets. However, they were microscopic, you know, between 1 and 2 millimeters, and did not give them any radiation and gave them vemurafenib. And you can get amazingly good control of the brain with vemurafenib. I know there's a paper that was actually published at last year's ASCO by Georgette Long looking at the same question of brain mets with dabrafenib. And our experience with vemurafenib is pretty much equivalent.
Will you do that in a patient with symptomatic brain mets?
Tough question. I guess in my head, symptomatic needs to be better clarified, because if someone comes in with left-sided hemiparesis and they've just bled into a right frontal lobe, that patient's going to the OR. I'm not going to mess with therapy. There's no way I'm going to get them to respond that much faster. I have several patients with diffuse leptomeningeal disease, symptomatic, because they have leptomeningeal disease, because there's nothing I can do about it.
Do BRAF inhibitors work with leptomeningeal disease?
I have two of them that are back to work.
Wow.
So, you know, to me, what's the definition of symptomatic?
Well, maybe I can flip it over and say, what would cause you to consider radiation therapy, if anything, in a patient with melanoma and brain mets?
Whole brain? Pretty much has to take an awful lot for me to really give somebody whole brain. Really does. Oh, I don't say that I won't ever do it, but my back's up against a wall and I've got a young person and they're going down the tubes and they have a BRAF mutation. I would probably give them whole brain and put them on a BRAF inhibitor all at the same time. However, you're not going to give them full dose BRAF inhibitor while you radiate their head, because there are documented reports saying that when you give concurrent whole brain RT with full dose VEMI, that you can actually see some brain necrosis later.
I thought you were going to say some problem with the scalp. Brain necrosis. Interesting.